Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. America the Gutted, what happens when the middle class disappears? This is a 10-month investigation by the world news site Global Post. They traveled from factory towns that have been shuttered in the United States to the emerging boom towns, which keep changing in the developing world. We, this hour, are going to be talking, and it's wonderful to have this kind of worldwide perspective. The journalists who are involved in this have written, as anybody who's been living through it can tell you, America's middle class, the backbone of the world's largest economy, is in distress. Median family income in America peaked in the year 2000, and since then it's down some 6%, the worst 12-year stretch for the middle class since the Great Depression. And yet, when you go to other parts of the world, the story may be somewhat different because there are numbers of people, notably in China and India, where the middle class is growing, and other countries in Asia, Latin America, and beyond. More people around the world are expected to ascend into the middle class. Why is that? What happened to those factories that used to be in shuttered towns in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, for that matter? Where did they go? Where are they now? It's a big issue, one of the big issues of our time, and we have two guests with us who are involved with this Global Post. Thomas Muka is editor of Global Post. He oversees the editorial operations. It has won a number of awards for coverage of the global economy and business, a Peabody Edward R. Murrow Awards as well. And Thomas has a master's degree in international relations from the University of Chicago. Thomas, thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and also for digging into this issue. As you point out, it is a really big one, not only for America, but for the world economy.
Mm-hmm. It is a big issue, and thank you for taking on the issue. Patrick Nguyen is also joining us. Patrick is based in Bangkok and is joining us by phone from Bangkok today. He is the Global Post Senior Southeast Asia Correspondent. He is documenting the region in flux, where despots experiment with democracy in places like Burma, Myanmar. Communists excel at capitalism in Vietnam, and cell phones are rife among peasants surviving on $2 a day, half of Indonesia. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Why don't we just start with, Thomas, the scope of this project? You are all over the world. You're looking at various countries, various continents, and it's a huge project. Where are you? What are you attempting to discover through all of this international reporting?
Well, you know, the big idea here, Kathleen, is to show this trend in its full. And as a global news organization, we have more than 100 professional correspondents all around the world. Our mission here at Global Post is to help explain Earth to our audience.
Mm.
And this decline of the American middle class, it isn't just a story for the United States. It's having implications all around the world, both good and bad. So what we did is we looked at three different and varied industries in the United States. Each of these industries have come under pressure from the decline of the middle class. So we went to North Carolina, and we looked at the textile and garment industry there. And then we went to the Pacific Northwest, and looked at iron workers and bridge builders who have come under pressure from low-wage competition from China. And then we also looked at another industry, the legal services profession, which is also being changed greatly by outsourcing, particularly to India. So we looked at these three industries and asked some pretty big questions. How is this great economic shift changing lives, not only in the United States, but all the way around the world? What's the future of the middle class in the U.S., but also what's the future of those around the world who are aspiring to reach middle class status around the world? So what we did is we identified specific people, specific workers in the United States, and then matched them up with the workers around the world who are, in many cases, doing the exact same jobs
mm-hmm.
Americans used to do.
Let's start with Wrangler Jeans in North Carolina, and it used to be a pretty good paying job. You talk about some of the workers there who had spent years and years and loved working there and were able to afford homes and cars and loved going to work every day, and all of a sudden it's gone. Where did those jobs go? Did they go to Asia, Patrick?
Yes, some of them did. A number of them actually went to the Philippines, and this was sort of a slow drain that started in the 90s with the entire garments industry in the United States. But yeah, of course they came to Asia, because when you can pay someone for a day's work what you would have to pay an American for an hour's work, businessmen are going to flock to the location that's cheapest. And I did my reporting in Manila, going to a factory on the outskirts of the city that makes Wrangler clothing, among a lot of other brands that Americans recognize as distinctly American, such as Lee jeans and clothes like that.
And you found that it allowed some people to become very wealthy there, but also people were allowed to enter the middle class, but also then, lo and behold, people could do it cheaper in other countries. So some of the jobs left the Philippines and went where?
Oh, they went to places that are much worse off than the Philippines. This is the fickle nature of outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
The factory owner I talked to is if you value the American dream, you know, the ideals of the American dream, you have to kind of root for this woman, because she went from a peasant to someone who owned a string of factories worth several million dollars. Good stuff, right? But, of course, she did that during the 90s and the early 2000s when American jobs were leaving and moving to the Philippines, where outsourcers got these great tax breaks and infrastructure projects set up. So she became wealthy, rags-to-riches story, but now she has found that there are other economies that are maturing, such as Cambodia is one, Bangladesh, which now is the fourth largest supplier of clothing to the United States. It's an extremely poor country where people will work for in a garment factory stitching clothes for about $40 a month. That's about the best you can do in all of Asia.
Did you talk to business leaders who made, like, the president of Wrangler Jeans or any of these other companies that you followed? Could you pinpoint a time when they decided that they were going to make the move to the Philippines and they listed the reasons for doing so? Or is all of this kind of secretive, Thomas?
Well, it's not that it's secretive. I mean, this is part of a trend, Kathleen, that's been going on for decades. Globalization took root in the late 70s and the early 1980s. We had all sorts of free trade agreements were being signed around the world. At the same time, China was booming, India was booming. You had the Asian economic tigers coming into their fore. So, you know, it's not that this is happening in the dark corners. This is very much out in the open. The problem is the net effect of this globalization was to put the American middle class on a level playing field with workers everywhere. And what that did is that tilted the power balance between employers and employees decidedly in favor of the companies. So while capital could flee across borders in search of cheaper opportunities, like Patrick has pointed out, labor has been stuck here at home. And that makes it much harder for Americans to demand better wages. So over time, the quality of life in America has been slipping.
And put it in personal terms, what happened to those workers that you followed at Wranglers once Wranglers left? How have they been able to maintain a middle class lifestyle or not?
Definitely not. The picture in North Carolina has been pretty dire. North Carolina, as a state, for example, is the state in the United States that has suffered most from outsourcing. It has really been hit hard. In particular, median household income in Bertie County, which is home to Windsor, where this Wrangler factory was, has fallen to about half of what it is for the U.S. as a whole. So what you find is in Bertie County in North Carolina, and also in towns all across America who have gone through similar things. People are struggling with a variety of middle-class costs, housing, healthcare, food, energy, education. So it's a dire situation in North Carolina and other places.
And if you sort of have a race to the bottom, Patrick, what happens once those jobs that were in the Philippines go to Cambodia? I mean, how low can you go here? Eventually, you're going to run out of places to go. Is it a similar story that people's incomes are going down and they're not a part of the middle class, even though they may define it differently, that another place is struggling?
Well, this is what countries have to do, where they have to mature their economies and become indispensable. And the Philippines is sort of struggling to do that. If you look in the region, their minimum wage is fairly high. That's daily, getting paid about $10, right? So you can go over to Cambodia and pay someone $2 a day to do the same thing. It's a much poorer country. But you can only go to Cambodia if you're dealing out jobs that are unskilled, that basically someone who has a third or fourth grade education can do. So, yeah, absolutely. They're sort of racing toward the bottom, and even China, which everyone thinks of as the big Goliath of unskilled labor, their minimum wage has gone up to about $4 to $7, and they're starting to lose jobs to places that are even poorer, like I mentioned, Cambodia, Bangladesh, and Vietnam as well.
So eventually there will be no place to go?
Well, if every economy matures to a point where there aren't people that will take these jobs, then sure. But as someone who lives and works in Asia and spends a lot of time among people who are very poor, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, tell me what the case is with unions. Were there people unionized at the Wrangler plant in North Carolina? Have there been unions in other places in the world, or are you not dealing with that issue in other places in the world? And maybe you weren't in North Carolina either. Thomas?
Well, there were definitely union issues in Manila. And Patrick, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, each country has its own political stylings. Vietnam, of course, is a ostensibly a communist country, right? But that just means a closed society with top-down government. You're not going to unionize there to any big degree. The Philippines has an American-style government, and they have a very people power vibe where politicians get votes promising these populist policies. And yes, there are union issues in the Philippines, and there's a strike culture and a rally in the streets type of culture, and that means that the minimum wage has been driven up. It could be, though, that they've priced themselves out of those unskilled jobs, though.
And Kathleen, if I might jump in for a
yes, of course, Thomas.
What makes this story so interesting and so important is that there are very dramatic implications to this trend, and many of them, of course, are positive. Around the world, people are living longer, they're living better, they're living happier lives. This tends to promote political stability. It also opens up new markets for U.S. companies, and all of this is good. But the problem for overseas workers is as they move towards middle-class lives in their own countries, they're not even near the levels enjoyed by Americans in recent years. The jobs are often tenuous, pay is often too low, the working conditions can be terrible. Social safety nets are not always fully developed. So it's the end result here is we've got unease and pain in America and largely better living standards abroad, but the future remains uncertain for everyone involved in this complex global equation.
Well, that's what we don't want to hear, that the future is so uncertain because it's affecting so many lives.
That's true.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. You can also reach us on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our Twitter handle is at K Dunn Show. So those are all ways to reach us for this important issue. We have two guests with us this hour. Thomas Muka is Global Post Editor, which is this marvelous and very important world news site. They have for 10 months now been investigating the shuttered factory towns of the United States to find out where the jobs have gone, and looking at the boom towns of the developing world. So they're looking, because a lot of the boom towns are in Southeast Asia right now, what's going on in Southeast Asia. It's a fascinating and more than slightly disturbing investigative piece, which will go on for some time now. Thomas is editor of Global Post, and Patrick Nguyen is based in Bangkok, where he is Global Post senior Southeast Asia correspondent. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking our show on the road, at least down the block a couple blocks, but Joy is taking her show on the road from Madison. This coming Wednesday, you'll have a chance to be part of our audience, a participating part of the audience, because I hope that those of you who love to follow politics and want to ask our variety of guest questions about issues like what we're talking about actually this hour, we're invited to be a part of our live studio audience. Come anytime between 6 in the morning to 11 o'clock. Joy will broadcast for a full 3 hours. We'll be doing 2 hours. We'll have some terrific guests with us, and you're invited to join us. Plus, we're going to have a little bit of food, some donuts, coffee. It's at the Pabst Cudahy Pub this Wednesday, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. Doors open at 5:30 in the morning. 144 East Wells Street in Milwaukee. It's a free event. You don't have to RSVP, but if you'd like to be polite, and that would be nice to be polite, we'd love to know if you're coming so we can plan accordingly. Learn more, register at wpr.org/Milwaukee, wpr.org/Milwaukee. We ask you this hour if your job has been touched by the global economy, and it looks by your response that a lot of you have been touched by this economy. How has it affected you? Maybe some of you for good or for ill, or perhaps for both. We are interested in hearing from you. We start with Ed in West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Well, Kathleen, the future isn't uncertain. We definitely know where this is going to end. Let's get some facts out here this morning. 500,000 unionized jobs lost in Wisconsin since 1946. I have lost my unionized job 4 times in my lifetime, caused a divorce. We have shuttered factories on every side of this town. George Meyer and the Delco plant on the south side, A.O. Smith, Cutler Hammer on the north side, right in West Allis, Allis Chalmers. Act 10 was directly responsible for the loss of unionized jobs. Private sector unionized jobs was directly responsible, a link to what Walker was able to accomplish in the state legislature a year ago. And the irony of all this is that we have no political leadership in the United States. Mr. Obama, if you looked at the debate, these two debates, union issues have not come up one time. I listened to the vice presidential debate last week, 92 minutes. We didn't talk about EFCA. We didn't talk about the National Labor Relations Act. We didn't talk about jobs being lost to all parts of the globe. And, of course, the race to the bottom is going to lead to violence.
Thomas.
Well, obviously, it's a very important issue to a lot of people. Clearly, decline of union power has played a significant role in this long-term trend. It is also important to note that these problems were a very long time in the making. I mean, this trend has been going on for decades, and in a lot of ways, it does transcend political parties and politics.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the attempts of both presidential candidates right now to paint the other side as villains, and as you've seen in the campaign, both parties have tried mightily to reach out to middle-class voters. President Obama has centered his whole campaign around the idea of restoring the middle class, at the same time attacking Mitt Romney for his experiences at Bain Capital and, more recently, his infamous comments about the 47% of Americans who are living off the government. And for its part, the Romney-Ryan campaign is also reaching out to this middle, desperately making the case that its economic policies are best for the middle class, And it's very easy to see why each side is doing this. Plenty of middle-class voters live in the swing states that each side needs to carry in November.
Well, the other thing that's hard to understand is plenty of middle-class voters have been affected by all of this, and they've seen their salaries cut in half in some instances, and they haven't been able to find jobs. And I guess they're looking for, as Ed would suggest, some kind of leadership and concern about this issue, because nobody wants to continue this way. We want things to be different. People want to have a good job and be able to buy a house and have a car, and they want to do that in North Carolina, and they want to do that in Thailand or in the Philippines, don't they? So isn't there a way to do that?
Well, do you mind if I jump in and talk about the race?
Yeah, go
the
ahead,
bottom?
Patrick. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I use that phrase in my my writing. But I just have to say, as they're racing to the bottom, people are being lifted up. That is very cold comfort to your caller. That's very cold comfort to members of my own family. I'm from a textile factory family in North Carolina, actually, and all those jobs are gone. But it's very comforting to think that when factories open overseas, maybe the conditions are really bad, and that the people that move those companies, those factories overseas, they're really mistreating people, so they're the villain. The conditions are not great, but the people who work in these factories often have an option between the factory or farming, which is back-breaking, brutal labor. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, well, that's important. Do you want to respond to this, Thomas?
I would like to reiterate that this is a very difficult problem for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, first, the politics of this is very complicated. The U.S. government, as it's done in the past, does have the option of spending more on social safety nets, things like unemployment insurance, worker retraining, adding more benefits for education, health care, and the like. But large government debts, both in the near term but also in the long term, are at the same time constraining government action here. The Congress and the country remains bitterly divided, so forging any sort of political compromise on this certainly won't be easy. And as we've seen in the increasingly bitter presidential campaign, positions are hardening on each side. So any sort of rapid government solution is probably out of the cards.
Let's go to Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen, to you and your guests. My background is in economics, so I could probably talk about this for hours. But to make this real simple, I think it's primarily the Clintons. Bill Clinton put through all those trade treaties with China, which facilitated large American companies moving offshore to China. And then when Hillary Clinton was in the Senate, she pushed through that bill that makes it almost impossible to declare bankruptcy from credit card debt.
Were trade treaties the problem, Thomas?
Trade treaties definitely contributed to the ability of U.S. corporations to go overseas. As I said before, it helped level the playing field for all workers, which gave incentives for U.S. companies to seek out cheaper labor. So it definitely played a role in this.
Mm-hmm. Rick is Rick was our caller. Mike is next in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, real interesting program. Seems to me that we're kind of sunk. I think that there's a very large group of people, probably between the ages of 40 and 60, who make up that mass of workers who worked in all of these factories which no longer exist. And, we can talk about retraining all you want, but it's really something that doesn't work. So in the short term, I think the U.S. society is somehow going to have to find a way to carry this group of people, over a period of time. I suppose in the long run, the positive thing is that as other countries' middle classes start to grow, that will then create markets for a future, U.S. boom as far as manufacturing of, new products. But, we're talking a number of years down the road.
That is one of the key trends that did pop up in our reporting, particularly on the American side. As we said before, we spoke with iron workers in the Pacific Northwest whose jobs have been pressured by competition from low-wage work in China. Several of the people we talked with were trying to do just this, get retraining, go back to school, do all those things that the script would dictate. But as you say, they're at an age where they are difficult to be hired. One of the guys that we spoke with said, I'm a smart guy, I'm a hard worker, but I'm 50. And, you know, employers look at me like I'm going to be dead in 10 years.
Well, what was there any way to just keep things the way they were, just to keep all these companies in the United States? And what would have been the outcome of that?
That's a very interesting question. It's a very complex question. I'm not sure that there's an answer to that. Globalization happened. And there are forces at work here that go far beyond the U.S. government's ability to maintain them. As Patrick has pointed out, this need to better oneself is a human need. And as opportunities presented themselves across the world, people naturally grabbed onto them. So it's a big, complicated problem that is beyond the scope of any one country to solve.
Your caller made an interesting point, Kathleen, about the middle class rising in foreign countries that we may have lost outsourcing jobs to. These people in the rising middle class, they like American stuff. They tend to think of Chinese stuff as junky, as do a lot of Americans, despite the fact that they certainly buy so much of it. If you go to look at the advertising for Wrangler jeans in America, you're going to see sort of a country western motif. The country singer George Strait has his own collection. But the newly rich in Asia eat this stuff up, but they are looking at advertising of cool, hip, young, usually Caucasian people running through a field with an American flag. That is a motif that sells. So whoever owns Wrangler is making money selling this stuff in Hong Kong, Jakarta, and Manila. However, the stuff is being made, right up the block or maybe 10 miles away.
And it's expensive, isn't it, in those countries?
It is expensive. And, you know, I was at the mall at a big Wrangler display, and I liked some of their clothes, but I thought it was a little out of my price range. It was $40 for a shirt. You know, that's a bit much. So, for sure, these are powerful brands, and Chinese brands do not have the same impact, and they are certainly not as desirable. I think anywhere in the world compared to American brands. So someone's making some money. I don't think it's necessarily the factory workers, though.
Right. Chuck in Green Bay writes, with such a dramatic difference in salaries, have those savings been passed on to the consumer, or has it just gone for greater profits?
It's very clear that the trend of globalization has done a lot to keep prices lower in the United States. So there's no doubt that Americans as a whole have benefited from this, and that's simply because if you're using China and other low-wage countries to produce your stuff, you can sell it back in the United States at a lower price. So it has helped suppress prices in the United States. That's clear. But it also, as we've been pointing out, creates other problems for the middle class.
Well, the whole thing's a catch-22, so the prices are lower, but you lost your job, so you can't afford anything that costs more anyhow, right?
Walmart has been a big winner in all of this, and Walmart is actually one of the companies that sort of represents the good and the bad of all of this.
You want to talk more about that? How are they the good and the bad?
Well, they are the ones that have benefited greatly from this trend of outsourcing because they have gone out and created a global supply chain where the products that they're selling back in the United States can be that much cheaper. So they've been able to benefit from that by dominating local markets all across the United States. That, of course, pressures other companies who compete with Walmart. And so it's just one of those. Walmart seems to be a good example of this trend. It's one of the companies that popped up and grew along with this trend.
Patrick, are you seeing companies like Walmart in Southeast Asia?
Absolutely.
Really?
Not Walmart per se. Yeah, there's a French outfit called Carrefour, and there's a British one called Tesco. and they are big box retailers. I live in Bangkok, and I can walk to either of these outlets from my house. I go to the most remote regions in Thailand for reporting sometimes, and those are the stores where people are buying their stuff. Now, unlike Main Street America, which has totally been eroded, people also shop in markets. So it's actually a pretty comfortable mix at this point. I don't know if that's going to change, but yes, big box retail is big in Asia.
Let's go to Michael in Milwaukee next. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Kathleen. I've been touched by this subject. I lost my job about 12 years ago when my job went to Mexico. My wife's job was lost when her job, she lost her job when her job was outsourced. I know so many people that are in the same situation. This is a terribly important, fantastic show, terribly important subject. In fact, this subject probably should have a whole day devoted to it, if not a whole week or maybe a weekly hour or a day or whatever. I mean, we certainly can't forget about what happened to our jobs. This didn't just happen. It was designed to happen. And when you hear a politician like Mitt Romney come up and, I'm going to get your jobs, these people were instrumental in getting rid of the jobs. They want it just the way it is. They're all making big money on it. Some people have touched upon the cost of the product. Well, you notice that as the Chinese or whoever's doing the outsourcing kind of captures the market, the prices tend to go up. You know, now we got $250 tennis shoes that are made in China. And the other thing is there's an extra hidden cost. Every one of these cheap products that you go out and you buy that supposedly is so cheap, because we are a country that, that takes care of the people that do not have jobs or can't find a job, because we're that type of a country. The people that don't have jobs, they're somewhat supported by the government, and that cost is a hidden cost that's in every one of these jobs or lost job products that we're buying. One other thing I'd like to touch on is the fact that we hear a lot of people complain about the fact that it's a real slow recovery. They say it's the worst recovery, the slowest recovery since the Depression. Well, the big difference with earlier recoveries compared to today is in earlier recessions, when the recovery started to come back or the recovery started, there were actually factories and places left where people could go to work. That didn't happen. Now, the powers that be made sure they tore down all the factories. They paved them over with parking lots or strip malls. And it's not going to be easy to retool America to get people back to work.
Thomas.
Was it Michael?
Yeah, Michael.
He makes a very important point here. For the American worker, each of the economic downturns that we've had since 1981 has been more bruising than the last. And in each of the successive recessions, the jobs have taken much longer to regain their pre-recession levels. So, for example, in 1981, it took 27 months for employment to recover. Then in 91, the next recession, which was relatively shallow, it took 32 months. The 2001 recession took a full 4 years, and now, following the Great Depression, it's been, 50 months or so. Unemployment is still more than 3 percentage points below normal. So that points to a long-term structural weakness in the current U.S. economy, as Michael points out. There just aren't a lot of those jobs still around that the middle class typically went into, and that's a real challenge.
For the first time this hour, we have some lines open. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. The global economy really is what we're talking about, and what's happened to all of those jobs that we used to have that have been outsourced. What happens once they get outsourced? We're talking with two of the people who have put together this remarkable project. It's Global Post. It's a world news site. And it's America the Gutted. If you'd like to read this, you can go to our page, WPR.org, click on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can read all of this. The reporters have spent a good long time looking at the complexity of this issue and going to various places in the world. Thomas Muchai is editor of Global Post. He is with us, and Patrick Nguyen is joining us by phone from Bangkok, where he is Global Post Senior Southeast Asia Correspondent. More phone calls momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Scott in Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. know, this is such a difficult topic. I mean, part of me looks at it and goes, you know, that we as consumers have this appetite for cheaper and cheaper goods, and we complain about Walmart, and we complain about Walmart, but we sure keep shopping at Walmart. You know, and if you try and find an American pair of khakis or an American pair of jeans, it's going to cost you $150 for a pair. My main question is about where do we go from here? I mean, one of your guests made a comment about textile industry, you know, in Bangladesh, where you only need a second or third grade education to be able to pay these people what you pay them to do the job. I mean, here in the States, so is it the case that you're not going to have a middle class lifestyle working in a textile mill? You're not going to have a middle class lifestyle doing the kind of jobs where you only need a second or third grade education. I mean, is that the point where we're at right now?
I don't think that's the point where we're at, although it probably feels that way to the people who are at the center of this storm, and understandably so. Most of the economists and experts who look at this point to a couple of different things. One is the need for retraining, is the need for greater education. And it's the need for the U.S. economy as a whole to continue to transform, not from the, you know, what it has always been for decades, manufacturing-based, but more towards high-value ideas economy. And there are some advantages there from the United States perspective. I mean, we still have the world's greatest educational institutions. We still have plenty of investment capital that's sitting on the sidelines. We still have great business ideas here. So that is one of the things that people point to, is this need for the American economy to evolve. But in the shorter term, another trend that we saw in our reporting is what's called Amerisourcing, or some people call it reshoring. And that's when jobs inside the U.S. move from higher wage areas or cities to lower wage areas inside the United States. So instead of U.S. jobs moving to Bangalore or Shanghai, they go from Boston and New York to places like Dayton, Ohio, or West Virginia. That's happening, for example, in the legal services industry in the United States.
Well, that's been happening for a long time, hasn't it?
It has indeed, yes. It's accelerating.
Thank you very much, Scott, for the call. John in Washington State writes, based on my experience over 30 years as a middle manager in a U.S.-based multinational company, the global economy can support only a fixed number of middle-class workers unless something new happens to allow the global economy to expand. That work will continue to migrate outside the U.S., and the U.S. middle class will continue to shrink unless we can continue to find new edges on quality. Am I right?
Yes, that is a very important point. And because it speaks to something that's central in economics, which is demand. Demand fuels economic growth. And what is happening here is that, you know, the United States is a consumer-based economy. Two-thirds of all economic activity comes from people buying stuff. And that's important because people buying stuff is profits for companies. And if companies have more money, they hire more people, and it's a virtuous circle. What's happened here is the middle of the U.S. economy, the world's largest economy, is being gutted. It's being hollowed out. So this trend hits businesses and hits the economy right where it hurts most, at demand. So you have all of these millions of people who have fewer resources to spend their money on things that companies need them to spend money on.
Yeah.
And the right spin, I mean, that's a fascinating thought, that there's also be spread around. I would add that the idea of a middle class is extremely relevant. These Wrangler products in the Philippines. One woman I spent a day with, she shares a toilet with her neighbors. She does not own a car. She commutes on a rickety bus. She has a TV but no refrigerator. She's hoping to get one for Christmas, and she's been saving up all of her money, and she's very excited. Now, that is, by any definition in America, a poor person, a very poor person.
Yes.
And if you were to tell this woman that she was poor, I think her feelings would be really hurt. She would say, but I'm doing well, because she can look outside on the street and see homeless women with eight children, and the kids are all beggars. So that is what the bottom means in some of these countries that have received American jobs, and the bottom and the middle class are defined very differently in the United States.
Yes. Let's go to Gary in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Yes, my question was, did you at all investigate how U.S. cultural beliefs have tied into this? And specifically, I was thinking of the idea that we somehow believe that we're God's chosen land and this is God's chosen people, and there's something special about us that, you know, doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, and so therefore we don't really have to worry because somehow everything will just kind of all work out because we're the best.
Well, I think Patrick hit upon that a little bit earlier, but in terms of your specific question, no, we didn't look at religious aspects of this or sort of the predestination aspects of the United States. But one thing that is clear is that the one of the religions in America, consumerism, has definitely taken root in countries all over the world. As Patrick's reporting points out, people aspire to brands, and a lot of people around the world are aspiring to American brands. And so this idea, which is largely an American idea of consumer spending, making it in the middle class means spending on all sorts of things, all sorts of brand name things, showing that you've made it by having the spending power to actually acquire goods, that has definitely taken root. Wouldn't you say, Patrick?
Absolutely, although I don't think any other country on the planet that has acquired American jobs can come close to consuming as much as the average American. Yeah, they're consuming more and more, but they haven't caught up with our habits yet. This could be the redefinition of expectations of the middle class moving into the future, where people perhaps realize that they simply do not have enough money to send their kids to college, where I think even lower middle class people in America still think that if they pinch their pennies, then they can send their kids on and get a higher education.
Well, the other question I guess you have to ask, not that it's a huge movement, but don't people get tired of just buying stuff after a while? How much stuff do you need?
That's a philosophical question.
I know.
Apparently they want more and more and more, and there are more people who are disposed around the world to acquire more and more. And, Thomas is right. They are following America's consumption habits in a major way.
Hmm. Let's go to Don next. Thanks, Gary, for your call. Don in Williams Bay. Hi.
Hi. My comment is my father was a steel worker and World War II vet, a steel worker, and he enjoyed the ability to return to work at a really good wage. And he used to sit me down when I was 14, 15 years old and say, you know, we'll never be in this position again. The world was destroyed. The United States came out of it unscathed, manufacturing-wise. And we're in a position to enjoy a great era here. But he almost said it to me as a warning. And it almost seems like his warning came true. We were able to enjoy great benefits for workers' compensation and unemployment and environmental laws, because we were in a position to have that huge pie to choose from. The other thing is, I remember Ross Perot making a comment, you know, we're no longer a nation of widget makers. Hmm. And I think that was a great statement some time ago. But I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Don. Thomas?
I think Gary's father was very wise. And the numbers that we looked at back up that assertion. From the time of World War II up until, you know, the 80s and 90s, the middle class was growing. Year after year, average annual income rose at a rate of about 2.5%. And, you know, taken together, that really created a strong middle, and it helped fuel the U.S. economy for decades. The question moving forward is, can that be repaired? How long will it take? And
and what impact will that have, not only on the U.S. economy, but also the global economy, because it's important to recognize that the United States economy is the world's largest, and therefore it's a source of demand for all sorts of other countries around the world. So as the U.S. economy goes into relative decline, how will that affect other countries? And there is definitely an interconnected aspect to all of this.
Hmm. And I will add that, I'm sorry, Kathy.
No, go ahead, please.
I will add that a factory owner that I profiled who makes Wrangler products in Manila, she said the two worst years of her life were 2001 and 2008. I think most Americans know what happened on those years. 2001 was the September 11 attacks, and it affected the economy. She was able to sell fewer products back to Americans. In 2008, the economy tanked, and she lost the equivalent of $1.7 million worth of holdings in her factory and almost lost them to the banks. That had everything to do with the fact that she was making American products for Americans and shipping them back, and the Americans just didn't have enough money to buy them anymore.
We are all connected.
We are all connected, aren't we? Sherry on Facebook writes, I'm wondering about the cost of shipping and how it will influence the cost of shipping raw materials overseas and finished goods back to America, whether jobs may shift back to the USA as the price of oil goes up.
That is an excellent point. That is likely to happen, most economists say. As energy costs rise and it's more expensive for companies to move things around, there is greater incentive to produce things inside the United States and lower those transportation costs. We are seeing some of that. Manufacturing in the United States has been on an uptick in recent months. The problem with that is that so many of these manufacturing jobs in the United States, as technology has marched along, are higher skilled jobs, meaning you need higher education, you need sometimes graduate education, and so it's difficult for people who were doing the existing jobs to move into those positions, or it's at least slower. And secondly, because of technological gains and productivity gains, there are just fewer of those jobs.
Hmm.
So the challenges are daunting.
Mm-hmm. We want to remind people, too, that there's a link to what we're talking about, because I know there's keen interest in this. America, the Gutted blog on our website, so you can go to WPR.org and click on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Joe in Lafarge is next. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I'd just like to ask a question and make a suggestion. When the economy can't provide enough jobs paying a living wage for the majority of the workers, maybe it's time to reexamine it and either retool or replace it. And Chris Hedges wrote an excellent book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. I'd like you to have him on.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Thomas, you want to respond?
I think that is the core question that we're dealing with today, and it's the core question of the America the Gutted Project. What is happening, and what needs to happen moving forward?
Let's spend just a little more time talking about China, because I'm wondering if China, where we still get a whole lot of things, but because wages are cheaper in places like Bangladesh or Vietnam, are they experiencing any of what we've experienced, maybe at the beginning stages, companies leaving?
Yeah, I can help answer that question. In my reporting, I focused on the garment sector, and the answer is yes. That means that Chinese companies that have contracts to make American clothes that we all buy in the shopping malls are double outsourcing some of that stitching down to Bangladesh and then getting it shipped back and then shipping it back to the States because they can make that much more money. China provides 40% of American garments, clothing, from overseas. And you will see that percentage erode because their economy is maturing and workers just won't do it as cheap as they used to. We talked about the race to the bottom earlier, and I keep bringing up Bangladesh because it's the place where the labor is the cheapest in this region, and it supplies the fourth largest supplier to the U.S. They're starting to see what that bottom is because people are going on strike. Indonesia is another country where people are saying, you know, I just simply can't get by on this
yes.
little money. I will risk my job by going on strike, and I know I might have to end up back in the rice fields, but it's worth it, and I think I can get away with it. And you are seeing wages get bumped up by a little bit in these countries because of that. So you can only push it down so far, and outsourcers are starting to see what the very, very bottom of the barrel looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathleen, if I might jump in for a moment.
Yeah, just quickly. We're out of time.
Okay, one quick point about China is their economy is also undergoing a great transformation. They're trying to move more towards a consumer-based economy like the United States and away from export-led growth. And so the main point here is keep an eye on China.
Mm.
We'll see lots of transitions there based on this trend.
Mm. Keep an eye on everybody, right? Thank you both so much. Thanks for doing this series. It's really important. We'll talk again. Thomas Mucha, Global Post editor, the world news site, and Patrick Nguyen joining us from Bangkok. He is Global Post senior correspondent for Southeast Asia. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. A reminder, on Wednesday of this week, we are broadcasting, taking our show over to the Pabst Cudahy Pub, talking politics. Maybe this issue will come up as well. Joy Cardine will be there as well. So from 6 a.m. until 11 a.m., we're broadcasting. Come and be in the audience and participate. We would love to see you there. Go to WPR.org/Milwaukee.